Drive-By Truckers is the name of a southern rock band, and Patterson Hood is its driving force. While his bandmates contribute some songs to the group, our music critic Robert Christgau says it's Hood's songwriting that really stands out. Here's a review of the latest album by Drive-By Truckers. It's called Brighter Than Creation's Dark.
For their first few years, the Drive-By Truckers were an old boogie band as crude and demented as their name.
When he reached the gates of heaven, he didn't understand.
In 2001, they revealed their higher ambitions by celebrating Lynyrd Skynyrd in words and music on a double CD called Southern Rock Opera. By then, Patterson Hood had proven himself an indefatigable teller of stories about Southern sinners. But the band's new album, Brighter Than Creation's Dark, begins with its protagonist in heaven as his friends cry around his deathbed.
Is there vengeance up in heaven? Are those things left behind? Maybe every day is Saturday morning. Two daughters and a wife. Two daughters and a wife.
Like the old cowpunks they are, the Drive-By Truckers have a soft spot for losers and total scuzzballs. They've also written more good songs about musicians than any competing road dogs you can name. But as they've gotten older, they've gotten more country. The great subject isn't losers anymore, it's strugglers. The character who sings the song I'll play now could be the same guy who was looking down from heaven on the one you just heard. Only problem is, he's still alive.
I got a brand new car that drinks a bunch of gas. Got a house in a neighborhood that's fading fast. Got a dog and a cat that don't fight too much. Got a few hundred channels to keep me in touch. Got a beautiful wife and three tiny kids. A couple big secrets I'd kill to keep it. I don't know God, but I fear his wrath. I'm trying to stay.
Patterson Hood has never been the band's only writer. On the new record, bassist Shauna Tucker has some songs, and Hood's longtime partner, Mike Cooley, also contributes half a dozen good ones, such as Lisa's Birthday.
It's always Lisa's birthday when I get that call. She's got no money for a cab. She's way too drunk to walk. Lisa's had more birthdays. And there are sad country songs about trying to love two women and only taking one girl home.
But Mike Cooley is second banana in the Drive-By Truckers. Usually his songs are less pointed than Lisa's Birthday. Less pointed than Patterson Hood's, too. Hood takes 9 leads on Brighter Than Creation's Dark, and just about every one is from the top drawer of a writer who's been prolific and consistent for a decade. The titles of Daddy Needs a Drink and You and Your Crystal Meth speak for themselves. Goodsfield Road is about a junkyard operator who commits suicide so his wife and kids get his insurance. The Monument Valley takes off from the John Ford film, The Searchers. And then there are two Iraq songs based on stories Hood was told by people he met. He admits that the soldier in That Man I Shot, quote, probably doesn't agree with a lot of my viewpoints. But he swears he got the guy's voice right. The voice of a struggler, and maybe a sinner, but not a loser.
The latest CD from the Drive-By Truckers is called Brighter Than Creation's Dark. Reviewer Robert Christgau is a senior critic at Blender magazine.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For most of his 30 years, Simon Flügel has explored the musical movement known as subminimalism. You probably know of him for the two-note cello concerto he wrote as a conservatory student. It was never performed by a full orchestra, but in transcription, its simplicity made it a natural for toddlers in Suzuki lessons. Now comes Flügel's most daring subminimalist composition, B-flat. It's the subject of critical acclaim in Europe, a forthcoming Canadian documentary film, and this review from our own Bryce Cobham Dowling. He says he's been listening to Simon Flügel's composition with amazement.
The clarion brass shriek at the outset stakes Flügel's claim in this, his most ambitious work. Not just a new composition, but a daring new aesthetic. Subminimalism at its most compact, and yet, at the same time, its most expansive. In its shrill passion, its martial angularity, its detextured monochrome ferocity, the trombone declares B-flat. And when it yields to a wooden recorder, we are back on familiar ground with Flügel, the quiet reassertion of the pastoral. We are reminded of Flügel's devotion, in his life as well as in his music, to the organic, and this is whole grain B-flat. Undeniably evident throughout is the sublime catholicity of Flügel's taste. There are passages redolent of Brahms, others that call to mind the early Rolling Stones. Of course, a capsule review cannot do justice to the power that these distinct yet identical tones convey in the title track of Flügel's new CD, B-flat and Other Notes, released by Modernitas on this first day of April. Just as the most subtle, somnolent shifts of Andy Warhol's sleep spoke volumes after hours of watching his actor toss and turn, in the self-same way, the most minute variations of tone and timbre virtually shout a gamut of emotions at us in Flügel's B-flat: pain, sorrow, triumph, hunger, satiety, flatulence. And a stunning moment of ironic social commentary at the end. The synthesizer, proclaiming technology the survivor of all feeling, all sentiment, all thought. Is Flügel's B-flat the last stop for subminimalism? I doubt it. Is it the exemplar to which all further reductions in the genre must be compared, and which, to warrant hearing, they must equal? I think so. And as Descartes would add, that's why I am so.
Bryce Cobham Dowling reviews music for PostmodernWatch.com and once a year for All Things Considered.
Baseball season starts in earnest today, so what does that mean? The best song in the world today is baseball related. Remember, the best song in the world today doesn't have to be the most popular or have the best groove, but it's got to have a good story. Producer Dan Pashman is here to tell us about it. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
So the music you're hearing right now is compliments of Steve Goodman and Jethro Burns. More on Steve Goodman in a minute. But today, as you said, Allie, is the real opening day of the baseball season. And this opening day in particular, people are talking a lot about my favorite team, the Chicago Cubs. And that's because this season marks 100 years since the Cubs last won the World Series. Now, there are a lot of ways to illustrate just how long ago that was,
yes.
But here's my favorite. The last time the Cubs won the World Series was 9 years before the Bolshevik Revolution.
That's a long time, Dan.
Yes, communism rose and fell, and the Cubs didn't win a World Series. But, you know, I wasn't always a Cubs fan. I actually grew up as a New York Yankees fan, and I converted to a Cubs fan as an adult, which took about 5 years. And you guys know me. You can imagine that's not a decision I came to lightly.
No.
Long story short, you know, the Yankees only consider a season to be successful when they win the World Series.
Yeah.
And I came to realize—
Well, because they do so often. The,
exactly.
You know,
high expectations. Yeah. And I came to realize that attitude takes the fun out of being a sports fan, basically because the most exultant moments in sports come when your team exceeds expectations, and they take your wildest dreams and fantasies and make them a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And if your team expects to do the very best thing that they can possibly do, then you can never exceed expectations.
Yeah.
There's only satisfaction, or disappointment.
Yeah. Or paying more for another player.
Yeah, or that.
Or ticket prices.
And that point was driven home to me when I went to the Yankees' clinching game of the World Series in 1998 and saw just how relatively unimpressed the fans were. It just didn't seem that exciting. Fast forward to 2003. I'm living in Chicago, rooting for the Cubs a bit, and in that year, the Cubs went on a very improbable run. All right, they exceeded all expectations. And Cubs mania swept the city, and the Cubs got into the playoffs. And when they just got into the playoffs, we poured out into the streets. They had to close down the streets around the ballpark, and we were all out in the streets singing and celebrating. We were singing Steve Goodman's cheesy but beloved Cubs anthem, Go Cubs Go. So at that very moment, there in the street singing Go Cubs Go, I realized that I was a Cubs fan.
He'd been baptized.
That's
he was
right.
Healed.
I said, amen. But that's not the best song in the world today. Because, you see, to really call yourself a Cubs fan, you have to experience some serious pain. And that's what happened to me a couple weeks later when the Cubs completely self-destructed just 5 outs away from the World Series. It was the most crushing defeat of my life as a sports fan. But the great thing about Cubs fans, I have to tell you, is that 99 years of bad teams and bad losses have not robbed the fan base of a sense of humor. And nowhere is that more evident than in the best song in the world today. Now, like I said, Steve Goodman wrote Go Cubs Go, which we just heard. So as you might guess, he's from Chicago, big Cubs fan. He also wrote The City of New Orleans, which was made famous by Arlo Guthrie, mm-hmm. and the famous country song You Never Even Call Me By My Name by David Allan Coe. And Goodman was a pretty successful singer-songwriter in his own right from the early 70s into the mid-80s. And throughout that time that he was singing, he was battling leukemia. And in 1984, sadly, he passed away at the age of 36. Mm. 11 days after Steve Goodman died, the Cubs played their first playoff game since 1945. And he was supposed to have sung the national anthem at that game, and obviously he could not. And instead, his friend Jimmy Buffett filled in mm-hmm. and took his place. But right before Goodman died, he wrote a musical will of sorts. It's a song that truly, to me, truly typifies the Cub fans' ability to laugh through the pain. And it's entitled A Dying Cub Fan's Last Request. And here's how it begins.
The dying man's friends told him to cut it out.
That's... It's another clip. But it begins sort of him talking about, well, this dying man is in his deathbed. And he's surrounded by his friends, mm-hmm. and they put his Cubs hat on, and they surround him, and he says, "You know, I'm never going to get to go to Wrigley Field again. I'm never going to get to see my team play again. But if you have your pencil and your scorecard ready, I'm going to read you my last request." Huh. And he sings the first chorus is sort of, "Do they still play the blues in Chicago?" He asks, and he asks questions like, "When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground?" He blames the Cubs for driving him to drink.
Oh, no.
He describes his... And then he goes on to describe his ideal Wrigley Field funeral in great detail. And, you know, he wants his coffin carried around the bases. He wants everyone to get peanuts and Frosty Malts. and then he wants his ashes... They want to build. He wants them to build a bonfire out of their bats. And here's the beginning of the song playing in the background. But so he's describing his funeral in detail. And he comes to the end of the song. And you know, he wants to build a big bonfire on home plate and throw his coffin, and he wants the ashes to blow out of the ballpark. And actually, his ashes were scattered over Wrigley Field after he passed away. And so I want to play the last part of the song after he's described his funeral in detail. And his friends are gathered around his deathbed. And this is the best song in the world today. It's A Dying Cub Fan's Last Request by Steve Goodman.
The dying man's friends told him to cut it out. He said, "Stop it, that's an awful shame." He whispered, "Don't cry, we'll meet by and by near the Heavenly Hall of Fame." He said, "I've got season's tickets to watch the Angels now. So that's just what I'm gonna do." He said, "But you, the living, you're stuck here with the Cubs. So it's me that feels sorry for you." And he said, "Oh, play that Lonesome Losers tune. That's the one I like the best." Closed his eyes and slipped away. Well, Scotty, it was the dying Cub fans' last request. So here it is. Do they still play the blues in Chicago? Chicago when baseball season rolls around. When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave.
Go Cubs.
And that is the best song in the world today. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Guys.
Yo sé que soy poco superficial y que me manejo en la promiscuidad.
We're listening to Panda, a Mexican emo core band. Emo, in case you're not familiar, is short for emotional. It's a type of music and an aesthetic. All right, picture kids in skinny black jeans and eyeliner, dyed, black dyed hair in his face, sort of brooding in the corner. It's one of the many social tribes, along with metalheads and punks, that's made its way across the border to Mexico. And emo kids there have not had an easy time this month. On March 7th, in Querétaro, a town north of Mexico City, an anti-emo mob, literally a mob, descended on a plaza where emo kids often hung out, and they severely beat three teenagers. The next week, emos were attacked in Mexico City as well. Joining us on the phone now is Joan Grillo, a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. He wrote about the anti-emo violence for Time magazine. Joan, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. So tell us a little bit more about the mob at Querétaro. What happened?
Well, there was a mob which organized over the internet. They posted up signs, a message on the internet saying, let's go to this square in Querétaro where they hang out and let's take back the square. And then they had a very aggressive kind of, you know, these people are gay, they wear makeup, you know, they don't have any culture, they're suicidal. Let's take them out of the square. So about 800 people met up. And stormed around the streets, and then some of the mob found three young emos in the square, and just, you know, beat the hell out of these three people. And there was very disturbing video of it, which some of it which the kids themselves were taking on their cell phone videos, and others some journalists arrived, and very disturbing video of, you know, a mob of hundreds beating up on three teenagers and leaving them bloody on the plaza floor to be taken to hospital.
And then these videos were uplinked to YouTube, so it's sort of a little bit of a cycle. The internet is used to create the mob, and then the mob takes pictures of what they've created.
That's exactly right. A lot of the people put these videos on the internet with celebratory messages saying, you know, this is great. You know, emos, you know, emos are dying. This is a great thing.
Now, the violence continued on Saturday when the emos held a March for Tolerance. What happened there?
There was a march in Mexico City for Tolerance, and it was supposed to be everyone coming together, punks and metalists coming together to show support, show solidarity, and speak against the violence. Unfortunately, you know, we were walking through Mexico City to this marketplace where a lot of young people hang out. About 200 people came up and started throwing bottles and screaming and shouting a lot of homophobic insults at the emos, and the police had to form a line to stop the people attacking the march.
So you brought it up twice. There is a degree that homophobia is at the root of a lot of this.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, a lot of the messages are very focused on the homophobic elements. Mexico, you know, homophobia is still quite a big issue. There's, it still can be difficult for a lot of gay people in a lot of Mexican cities. Sorry, can you hear me okay?
I hear you great, yeah. Now better now, yes.
What about that, yeah. There's still a lot of homophobia in a lot of Mexican cities, and a lot of the... I'm sorry.
No worries.
And a lot of the insults are focused very specifically on this, very clearly on this. there's when you saw the March attacks, a lot of people were shouting very clearly kind of the Mexican words for, you know, insults people use for gay. And that seems one of the, a lot of the people like who have worked with youth in Mexico City say that is one of the main causes of the grievance people have against the emos.
It's also interesting, I went on a couple of the websites, and they're really sort of stunning in how vitriolic they are. One of the issues also seems to be class here. On one site, there was a posting that said, emos, hipsters, and trust fund babies should die. The next genocide should be based on cultural classes. Is there a clash, a class rift between the emos and some of the other music tribes we were talking about?
Yeah, I think that's right. A lot of the emos in Mexico, as in the United States, tend to be middle-class kids. A lot of them are middle-class teenagers. They're 15 or 16 years old. They're often going to private schools in Mexico, you know, living in some of the better neighborhoods. And some of the other kids are coming from these quite tough barrios, and they see these emo kids as being privileged, and you know, as well as being gay in their minds, as being privileged. And I think that as well, that drives as well their hate. Although there's a lot of you know, wealthy Mexican, and there's been no real kind of tradition of fighting among different class groups in Mexico, particularly. But that, I think that's one of the things which stirs up the violence here.
We're speaking with Joan Grillo. He's a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. He wrote about the anti-emo violence for Time magazine. There's also an on-air personality who is involved in all this. It's not just in terms of on the internet and terrestrial broadcast as well. There's a young guy, I was watching him, and he was really pretty, I don't want to say he was calling for violence, but he was definitely not telling people to chill out and be cool about it.
Yeah, there's an on-air personality in Mexico called Christoph. He's on a TV program or TV channel called Telehit, which is a TV channel about music aimed for young people. And he came on the channel and said that emo culture is worthless. It's all about teenage girls who fancy the lead singers of bands. And they started using a lot of swear words, you know, being very aggressive, you know, suddenly turning to English using these quite hard curses. I don't want to repeat here. And you know, really seeing this is rubbish, it's garbage, it's worthless culture. And he said that, you know, a few days before this big attack happened in Mexico City. So that, you know, didn't look very good. It looked like, in a way, he was inciting, to an extent, inciting the violence.
Are authorities taking this seriously, Joan?
Well, yeah, they are. To an extent, in Mexico City, they are.
Yeah.
They try to arrange a sit-down between emos and other groups before the march. And then they sent a lot of police out to protect the emos. Unfortunately, in some ways, it doesn't, you know, it can make, antagonize the situation as well. When you see a group of these emos marching, protected by a group of riot police, it makes the other kids even more angry.
Absolutely.
They, you know, why are these kids being being protected?
Joan Grillo is a reporter in Mexico City. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you very much.
Hey, next on the BPP, it's April Fool's Day, don't you know? There are hijinks happening on the internet. The lowdown next. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brandon. Alex, let's say you go out to dinner. And you go to an expensive restaurant, you pay a lot, or you pay a lot for a bottle of wine. Is it better? Is the food better? Is the wine better if you pay more?
I kind of expected it's going to be, and that probably colors how I feel about the meal. Yeah.
Right, right. Well, also, conversely, you could go maybe to a diner or to a burger joint and have an incredible conversation with someone, and maybe you'd think that that dinner was...
That would be a valuable meal, sure.
Fantastic. Well, so we can all agree probably that value isn't always as simple as what something costs. And take music, for example. Artists and fans are... Well, they're struggling over how much you should pay for an album.
Yes, and this is all the debate about online and downloading and, yeah.
Right. Remember that album In Rainbows that Radiohead released last year? It was a digital download.
Yeah, pay what you want.
You could pay nothing. Well, the musician Moby has launched a website. It's called MobyGratis.com. It's where independent filmmakers can download some of Moby's music for free. I asked him if he thinks free downloads and even illegal downloads lessen the value of art, lessen the value of his music.
I think that's a very good question, because when I was growing up, I mean, the first job I ever had was as a caddy at a golf course. And I worked for 2 weeks just long enough to save up money to buy a David Bowie record. And so, boy, when I got that David Bowie record home, it was the most valuable thing I owned. And everything about it was valuable, like the artwork, the sleeve, the vinyl itself. And I studied it for, you know, for days and days and days. And now, if you're able to download something for free, it does potentially diminish the value of it. But at the same time, my only hope is that, I don't know, somehow music will transcend this. You know, a great song is a great song, whether it's on vinyl or CD or cassette or reel-to-reel or MP3. And again, that might be overly, it might be an overly optimistic view, but I do think that great music will transcend the medium in which it's delivered.
Now, you got a lot of criticism when your album Play came out and the fact that you let all the songs, most of the songs, be used in TV for advertisements or on film, movie soundtracks or TV.
It's sort of, there's this half-truth, which is that all the songs from Play were licensed commercially. All the songs off of Play were licensed, but 90% of the licenses were to independent films and nonprofits. But yeah, I've certainly been crucified over and over again for licensing a lot of my music.
Does that dilute the value of it, though? Because, I mean, it, for a while, you couldn't turn on TV without hearing one of your songs as mm-hmm. a backdrop for an advertisement. And I'm just wondering, then, does it become the song is not about connecting with a listener, it's about selling something?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, one of the reasons that I licensed my music was, in the past when I've released records, they didn't get much press support, they didn't get a lot of radio play, they didn't get MTV play. So the only way I had in which to get people to listen to my music was by licensing it to movies or advertisements. Granted, that is sort of self-serving because I've made a record that I care about. I wanted people to hear it. The other reason, and I don't want to sound like I'm being overly defensive, is I grew up very, very poor. You know, my mother and I were on welfare and food stamps till I was 18. So I've always had this ethos of, like, try and make a little bit of money now because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
I'm wondering personally, do you value things less if you don't pay for them? And if you could put that into context with your David Bowie Lodger story, now that you do have more money, mm-hmm. would you value that album less because you could easily pay for it?
It's such a good question. I don't know. I mean, I guess to some extent one could argue that the value of something should transcend its cost. The value of something should be subjective. You know, if you love something, you should love it regardless of whether it costs $5 or $500 or $5,000. Unfortunately, that's not really the way our culture works. And we do collectively buy into this idea that things that are more expensive probably have more value. For me, how much I spend on something doesn't really affect how much I value it. Not to say that I'm enlightened. I don't know, somehow I don't associate cost with value.
But now that you have more money, you're relatively mm-hmm. well off, does that change the way you view view things than when you were a golf caddy?
I mean, for some reason, luck or fluke, I have no idea. As a musician, I've managed to make a decent amount of money. But my spending habits are the same as they were 20 years ago, much to the chagrin of my friends. Like, my friends all think, like, oh, you've made some money, go do something fancy and extravagant.
And take us with you.
Yeah, and I still buy my soy milk at the deli on Prince Street, and I still take my laundry to the same laundromat. So, like, I don't feel compelled to spend money just because it's there. Like with televisions, I have a small television, and it works just fine. I don't know that having a big, gigantic television would necessarily make The Family Guy any funnier.
Although it is pretty funny.
It is pretty funny, but it's just as funny on my little 14-inch television as it would be on, like, some gigantic, enormous flat-screen plasma thing.
If you had to pay for it, I could reverse that. If you had to pay for The Family Guy, would it be worth more to you, do you think, than if you got it for free?
Me personally, I don't think so. Maybe for other people it would. And at the end of the day, not to be too naive and philosophical, but life is short, and if something makes someone happy, far be it for me to criticize them. You know, if someone spends $100 on a new pair of shoes and they really love the pair of shoes because it cost them $100, and if it makes them happy, more power to them, you know, because at the end of the day, we all end up in the same place. And so if you can create a degree of happiness while you're alive, even if it's through something like getting a new pair of shoes, again, far be it for me to criticize it.
Have you heard of this thing called the Mobi quotient?
Yeah, I was actually just talking about that with a friend of mine earlier. And I guess it's like it's the quotient of how much someone has sold out or not.
What do you think of that?
I think it's a little odd that I've somehow ended up as like the poster child for selling out, when the truth is, for better or worse, and this is a sad thing to say, everyone does it. In 99, 2000, 2001, I got a lot of criticism from journalists about licensing my music. What seemed particularly ironic is that a lot of these articles were written in magazines that are sustained by advertising revenue. It's just odd that people buy into this corporate consumer culture and then will criticize people who are involved in corporate consumer culture. You know, I mean,
do you think he's being hypocritical?
I think to an extent. But it's hard because a lot of times I find, but we all tend to have different standards for strangers than we have for ourselves. You know, we do all, myself included, we tend to hold ourselves to pretty low standards. But when it comes to judging public figures or politicians or people we've never met, we tend to hold people to very high standards. And if we held ourselves to those standards, we'd always fall short.
Well, Moby, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Moby. His new album is called Last Night. It's due out tomorrow. And by the way, it is not a free digital download. Here's a sample, though, that we caught streaming for free on his website.
Until I turn over.